people think there is no cause for crime, except the pure cussedness of the ones they call a criminal. But as a matter of fact, there's a cause for everything in this world. And there's no way to remove the evil without removing the cause. There's a cause for all sorts of human conduct, just exactly as there's a cause for all the physical action of the universe. The real cause of crime is poverty, ignorance, hard luck, and generally youth. These almost invariably combine to produce what we call a crime. When we look at the prisoners in the jails, we find that all of them practically are poor, at least 9/10. And these have always been poor. At least 9/10 began what they call a criminal career as mere children. 11, 12, 13, at a time of life when the ways of life are fixed. 9/10 of them also are ignorant. They've never had the training that every intelligent parent would think was necessary to keep their child out of prison and make him safe in the community. All of these things almost universally combine to put people in jail.
Whether he was defending two of the most notorious killers in the 1920s or making unorthodox legal maneuvers in the famous Scopes trial, Clarence Darrow was a convincing speaker. In the rough-and-tumble legal system of the early 20th century in America, how did Darrow become the most prominent attorney of his times? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What kind of cases did Darrow take? What were his personal politics and principles? And what effect did he have on the legal profession? Once again, our guest is criminal defense lawyer and UW and Marquette adjunct professor D.N.A. Strang.
Welcome back to University of the Year.
Good morning.
Is it fair to say that Clarence Darrow is probably the most famous lawyer in American history?
I've made that claim.
Okay.
In this sense, I think you can make a good argument. It's not unassailable, but you can make a good argument that of all the lawyers in American history, Clarence Darrow is the lawyer most famous for being a lawyer, as opposed to, you know, being a president or a senator,
right,
or a judge or what have you. Again, the claim isn't uncontestable, but it's not preposterous either.
Well, and he was born in 1857. Tell us something about his background, his childhood, the time and place that he came from that would shape him as this defender of the poor and the downtrodden, the one that would take on rebels and criminals later on in life.
He was essentially a middle child, I think maybe fifth of eight, although one of the older siblings died ahead of him. So he winds up just about in the middle of the pack. He's born to Democrats in a very Republican area of northeastern Ohio, very near the Pennsylvania border and Pennsylvania Dutch country, a little tiny town. He's not actually born in Kinsman, Ohio, but he's raised in Kinsman, Ohio. As I say, his father in particular was a Democrat, but a strong anti-slavery Democrat at that. So the sort of contradictions that characterized Darrow's personality and his life really can be traced back at least to Amiris, his father. Jennifer is his mother. He grows up loving baseball and hating school. He's a lackadaisical student at best. He's a dreamer, much again like his father, who today we might sort of casually call the father the village atheist. In fact, the father had been trained as a Unitarian minister but never gathered a congregation, I think in part because he lost faith even in Unitarianism. Father kept the family together by being the local coffin maker and furniture maker. The family built the only octagonal home in town, certainly, and probably for many miles around. So they just were, they were an unconventional group, were the Darrows. And Darrow describes, by and large, a happy childhood other than the very early loss of his mother when he's maybe 13 or 14.
And somewhere in there, though, there's a transformation from this dreamer to somebody who, by the time he's in his 20s, is involved in some major legal cases.
It's actually later that he becomes involved in the legal cases. His initial trajectory is very local, just as his father's had been. His father was a voracious reader, a thinker, but never really integrated his ideas and his ideals with his working life, at least with his working life. And Clarence very much was on that track for a long time. He, in spite of his almost disinterest in formal schooling, he came back to be a teacher after the family's finances didn't allow him to remain in college after a year. And he did fairly well at teaching. He was very popular, at least among the students, because recess periods were lengthened, lessons were shortened, and he would go out and play with his students during recess periods at the one-room schoolhouse at which he taught. He then decides to learn law on his own, and he's very much an autodidact in that way. He simply gathered up law books, read, eventually sat for a bar examination in a tavern, I might say, and the oral bar examination by the bar examiners. It was mixed, I suspect, with a good deal of drinking over a long evening. He passed the bar and was admitted, but set up a practice very near Kinsman. Ashtabula was almost too big a town for him, and he's doing the common work of the mid-19th century for lawyers, which is to say small contractual disputes, disputes over real estate boundaries, the occasional criminal case, just, you know, writing wills.
I saw that he had said at one point that inside every lawyer is the wreck of a poet. And I'm thinking as he's doing these wills and sort of tedious cases, there must have been that dreamer and poet inside of him that wasn't feeling particularly satisfied.
The dreamer had always been there. The poet, I don't know. Darrow wrote a lot, and he wrote idealistically in his life. His writing isn't particularly poetic.
But he quotes poetry a lot.
He quotes poetry a lot. He was a great fan of Omar Khayyam.
Interesting choice. I mean, very popular at this time, but
right.
Not one that would resonate with most Americans.
No. As so much of what Darrow became didn't resonate with most Americans. He had a brief, very sort of tempestuous partnership with a poet, actually, and I'm blanking his name, but the writer of the Spoon River Anthology.
Oh, that was Edgar Lee
Masters.
Yeah.
And he and Masters, as I say, it was a tough partnership, and Masters cycled over the course of his lifetime through intense like and intense dislike of Darrow. But there may be something to the notion that he at least was drawn to poetry. It's not until he's probably, you know, close to 30 that he moves his wife and himself up to Chicago, just sort of out of the blue. He had an older brother who was teaching school in Chicago, but there wasn't any other real connection to that city. He just uproots from this small town practice, goes to Chicago, and there he really does thrive. But the Darrow we know doesn't emerge until he's about 37 years old.
That late. What about the Darrow that we know as a speaker? This is a time when speeches were still known for their length and their passion, almost regardless of the topic.
Early in his life, in his 20s, Darrow takes some advantage of what is essentially, I think, probably lawyer's prerogative of the 1880s in a small area of being the orator at a 4th of July celebration or when a politician comes through making an introduction and an initial stump speech or something. When he gets up to Chicago, he needs to build a practice. He's a stranger in town. He has no practice when he arrives there. And he looks for opportunities to speak in the way that young lawyers today might look for opportunities to be in the newspaper or get a few seconds on the evening news locally. He's looking for opportunities to speak and get his name out there. He attaches himself to Henry George and the single taxers who were popular at that time. He gets involved in local Democratic politics in Chicago and Cook County and looks for a chance to get behind the lectern, you know, give a short speech or an introductory speech. And it's during this time that he actually gives a great deal of thought to oratory and to public speaking. And although he had grown up sort of fashioning himself after the traditional sort of oratory that he would hear politicians use, he decides as a young man in his late 20s, early 30s in Chicago that he ought to abandon that style entirely, that it's overly florid, it's full of cant, it's insincere. And he does. And he abandons that style of oratory and becomes a very conversational speaker, very striking to people who might gather in a hall and be expecting at that point still to hear long-winded oratory.
So already the opposite in some ways of a later adversary, William Jennings Bryan.
Yes.
Who's giving these fiery stump speeches as we get into the 90s.
Yes, that's very much true. He adopts a different style entirely of a congenial companion, maybe, you know, the sense of sitting in armchairs and having a discussion in front of the fireplace. And that remains his style, a very plain-spoken, much humor mixed in for the rest of his life.
What do we know about his religious beliefs and his ethics at this point? I mean, he's going to Chicago, not known for its lack of corruption, and he's coming, you said, from a father known as the village atheist. What about Darrow's own beliefs and his own sort of code of ethics?
Darrow, so far as I know, never confessed any particular religious belief. I don't know that he ever got to the point of declaring himself an atheist. He certainly later in life is very comfortable describing himself as agnostic. He's not much interested in heavenly affairs or the, you know, sort of religious notions. Indeed, he essentially rejects the whole idea of free will in men. He's very much a determinist as a mature man.
Popular ideas of the day.
Popular ideas of the day. That's right.
Prominent writers. We're starting to see that in American writings.
Right. Yes. I mean, so Darrow is never really entirely original. He's not really an intellectual leader, but it's that sort of determinist camp of thinking that characterizes his own mature thought. His ethics, there's no reason to question until later, when he becomes the Darrow that we know popularly. He attaches himself early in Chicago to John Peter Altgeld as a mentor, who, as governor of Illinois, pardoned the surviving Haymarket defendants, and in doing so, completely lit his own political career on fire.
The Haymarket riots having taken place in 1884 in Chicago. Big labor.
I think May 1, 1886, I think.
Big labor history landmark.
Yes.
And was that the case that brought Darrow into prominence, or what was his breakthrough moment?
Darrow's breakthrough moment, if by that you mean when does this shift come in his career, and why do we remember him today? That comes in 1894. He's risen very rapidly in the Chicago bar through a speech he gave, drew the attention of a man named DeWitt Cregeer, who very shortly after that speech became the mayor of Chicago. Darrow, at Krieger's invitation, lands a position in the Corporation Counsel's office. He moves up in that office. And from there, he moves to become what today we would call vice president and general counsel of a large railroad. I mean, a very large corporate concern, the Chicago and Northwestern Railway Company. And he's doing that. He's happy. He's making an enormous amount of money for the time. I mean, he's really living a life, again, that you would associate today with someone who's at the very top of, in-house corporate legal position. And then in 1894, Eugene Victor Debs leads the fledgling American Railroad Union or Railway Union out on strike against the Pullman Company and against any railroad that was entraining Pullman cars, which meant that Debs and the American Railway Union are striking Darrow's employer, the Chicago and Northwestern Railroad. Darrow has a crisis of conscience. I mean, he's always been philosophically on the side of labor, of working people. But here he is working for the man, so to speak. I mean, drawing his paycheck and very comfortable living from a large corporation. And Darrow literally one day walks into the office of the president of the Chicago and Northwestern Railway and resigns his position and says, I'm on the side of the strikers.
That must have taken quite a bit of courage.
I think it took an enormous amount of courage. Mm-hmm. And it's the point at which Darrow integrates his ideals and his work in a way that his father never did. And that's the Darrow we know. I mean, Darrow would be forgotten but for that crisis of conscience and resigning his position and then immediately taking up the representation, literally, of Eugene Debs.
Really switching sides in short order. And so what does he do for Debs?
He represents Debs in the two criminal cases, contempt cases, that come out of the strike that Debs led. At the time, now we're in 1894, the federal government very reliably would come to the aid of corporate interests when they faced labor unrest or work stoppage. Typically, a lawyer chosen by the affected corporation or by, you know, a corporate group would be appointed as special assistant United States attorney and would represent the interests of the United States nominally and actually, of course, the corporate interests in seeking a federal injunction against the work stoppage or the strike. The basis for federal jurisdiction, at least as to railroad strikes, always was that a railroad strike would affect the moving of the U.S. mails.
Oh, interesting angle. Mm-hmm. So it's not just interstate commerce.
It was the moving of the mail and the postal office. And so federal courts would take jurisdiction and could be relied on to side with the employer in labor disputes in that day. Debs then encourages the strikers to violate the federal court's injunction. He's charged with contempt and with a separate conspiracy charge and is tried.
Yeah. So how can Darrow mount a defense against that? It's pretty clear that Debs was doing what the prosecution was claiming.
Well, Darrow won one and lost one of those cases. He actually won one of those cases. He lost the other, and Debs did several months in the Woodstock, Illinois jail. But this launches Darrow as a champion of labor and a favorite of labor and also gets him involved for the first time in a serious way in criminal defense.
Does he take a big pay cut?
He takes an enormous pay cut, although that's not to say that Darrow didn't also eventually command some of the biggest fees that any criminal defense or labor lawyer could get in his day. I mean, he certainly becomes, not at that moment in 1894, but very quickly, he becomes a nationally known lawyer, a lawyer of great repute, and someone who can command a large fee. But there are many, many lean months and years for Darrow, too, as there often are for people who practice criminal defense or are in a solo practice, dependent on what and who walks in the door.
How does the American Civil Liberties Union come in?
Darrow is not a founder of the ACLU, but he's very much involved with the people who are founders and early leaders of that. Dudley Field Malone and Darrow are friends. Right now I'm blanking the name of another prominent ACLU lawyer from New York. But
Darrow doesn't have any formal ties with the ACLU. He's still, as you say, just kind of a solo lawyer.
He is. I mean, never. I don't know whether he ever, you know, sent in his dues to join the ACLU. Probably. And he's got working relationships that are quite strong and quite deep with, again, with people who founded and led the early ACLU. For example, when we get into the 20s and Darrow is representing the Ossian Sweet family in Detroit, that's very much an ACLU venture as well. Scopes, the Scopes trial that's so famous, is an ACLU venture, and it was the ACLU who brought Darrow in to Scopes.
And we're going to look at the Scopes trial when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air. Darrow makes a transition to criminal law and gets accused of a crime himself. We're going to find out about that when we continue with the University of the Air.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Dean Strang. We're looking at the life and career of Clarence Darrow, one of the most famous of all American lawyers and perhaps the most famous one of the late 19th, early 20th century when it comes to his reputation simply as a lawyer. We have already, I think, alluded to these sort of undercurrents in Darrow's career having to do with ethics. And is it an ethics charge that brings about Darrow's career change?
It's a criminal charge, if you mean his career change.
Away from labor unions.
Away from labor unions. Or more accurately, labor unions and the labor movement beginning to withdraw from Darrow. In the fall of 1910, someone set a bomb outside the printing plant of the Los Angeles Times, which was a virulently anti-labor newspaper at the time. Many, many working people in the printing plant are killed when the bomb explodes, does massive damage and kills, I forget the exact number, 19 is what I want to say, but I'm not sure that's right. It's a lot of people who die, and they're all working people who die in this bombing. Eventually, two brothers who are unionists are arrested for the bombing, James and John McNamara. They're charged in Los Angeles with many counts of murder for the bombing, and the labor movement nationally
has to distance itself from that, I would think.
Well, no. At the time, the view was that the McNamara brothers were being framed by the owner of the Los Angeles Times and other large corporate interests. Unions all over the country are trying to raise the money to retain Clarence Darrow, who's been labor's hero. Working men and women are sending nickels and dimes literally from around the country to build a defense fund to retain Darrow. Darrow is retained. And shortly before the trial is to start, while they're actually in jury selection, Darrow walks in one morning to court and pleads both McNamara brothers guilty. to spare their lives. It reached an agreement with the district attorney that one of them would get a life prison term and the other one, I think, 10 years if they would plead guilty and neither would be hanged. And this works in the, you know, in that sense. Both men's lives are spared. Both eventually came to be paroled. But Darrow becomes a pariah to the labor movement at that point.
Because he didn't make a case of it, didn't defend them?
He didn't defend them. He acknowledged their guilt. He pled them guilty. I think it would be hard for us to understand now just how crushed and disappointed organized labor was in Darrow when that surprise turn occurred in the McNamara trial.
Did the McNamara brothers want that approach? I mean, is that why Darrow took the...
I mean, even then, their pleas would have had to been voluntary. A lawyer had much more control over that than a lawyer does now. There's much more effort to assure the personal voluntariness of the accused in a guilty plea today. But even then, the pleas would have had to be voluntary. Within days of those guilty pleas and the collapse of Darrow's following by organized labor, Darrow himself is charged with attempting to bribe jurors from the McNamara case. I mean, you'll recall that they were in the midst of jury selection when the guilty pleas were tendered to the court. A man named Bert Franklin, who was sort of a shady kind of investigator working for the defense, got arrested for attempting to bribe a juror on the street. He fingers Darrow, and Darrow is indicted. And what follows for almost 2 years are two trials in which, you know, Darrow himself is the criminal defendant. In the first one, he retains the services of the next most famous lawyer in America, a very flamboyant San Francisco lawyer named Earl Rogers. Darrow is acquitted in the first trial, and the jury hangs in the second trial. And
these are two different offenses, obviously, that he's being tried for.
Yeah, and he could have today you'd be tried together for them, but there were two separate counts, and for whatever reason, they were tried separately.
And do you think he was guilty of one or both of the charges?
You know, I don't know that I can give a fully informed opinion on that. This is something that a lawyer and law professor named Jeffrey Cowan tackled at great length in a book several years ago. It's something that a very prominent, brilliant lawyer and law professor named Mike Tiger is taking on again. I expect that Mike Tiger's book will be published in 2014, probably. He's working actively on it now. There certainly are many people. In fact, I'd say the prevailing opinion is that Darrow probably was guilty. I don't know that he was, and it would be so exceedingly strange and contradictory because Darrow, of course, we know now, had been in secret negotiations with the district attorney to reach the guilty plea and the plea agreement from the McNamara brothers for days, if not weeks.
Yeah,
so Darrow knows
sense,
the case isn't going to be tried.
So it wouldn't matter with the jury.
Why he would have been involved actively in trying to bribe jurors who never would sit, never would hear evidence, and never would decide the case is a mystery. But one has to understand in looking at Darrow that his life is full of contradictions and just irreconcilable paradoxes.
Do we see that sort of thing, these attempts to bribe jurors or somehow tamper with a jury? Do we see this fairly often among other prominent American lawyers of the time?
I don't know that you could attribute it to prominent lawyers, but a tussle over the loyalties of jurors was very common, I think, in the 19th and early 20th century because the process of impaneling jurors was very slow. And the veneer, that is the list of prospective jurors, was well known to the lawyers on both sides.
And the jurors were that accessible.
The jurors were accessible. It was common for district attorneys to engage private investigators themselves, people from the Burns Agency or the Pinkerton Agency. Those people were not above unscrupulous tactics very often. And the defense, you know, would do the same. So it was very common to have this sort of tussle, if you will, for the loyalties of jurors. And I suspect that palms were greased not infrequently.
You mentioned in your book last week when we talked about the Milwaukee bombing case of 1917 that Darrow, in the process of taking the appeal for that case to the Wisconsin Supreme Court, engaged in something that looked like an ethics violation as well.
Well, if it was true, it looked very much like a crime in okay. addition to a serious breach of legal ethics. As, again, with so much with Clarence Darrow, in the end, you can't really be certain that you know what happened. But in the Milwaukee appeal, as you describe, there was at least the self-inculpatory sworn testimony of a former assistant district attorney who said that he and his boss, the district attorney, together cooked up this idea to approach Darrow with a plan to fix the appeal of the Milwaukee 11 if Darrow would reach out to Italian radicals and call off the threats against their lives. That's pretty powerful evidence in the sense that it was sworn testimony and it was from a former prosecutor who admitted his own involvement, his own criminal involvement in the scheme. But then he also said, you know, then I left the office not long after the meeting with my boss and Darrow down in Chicago. I don't know if our agreement ever came to pass. And indeed, I think, as I mentioned in the last hour, if in fact there was more than an agreement, an actual attempt to falsify the trial record on appeal in the Milwaukee case, it failed in the sense that the Wisconsin Supreme Court, although it reversed most of the convictions, did so on grounds you couldn't have contrived or mm-hmm. falsified. So we're left simply not knowing whether Darrow agreed corruptly to, you know, commit a crime, mm-hmm. commit a fraud on the Wisconsin Supreme Court, or whether this was just a strange and wild accusation by somebody who inculpated himself in it.
So after the Milwaukee case in 1917, and by now he's pretty much out of the labor business when it comes to being a defense attorney. Is it so to speak, a life of crime for Darrow at this point?
By and large, after 1913, Darrow's work was – his legal work was criminal defense by and large. He never really gets back fully in the good graces of organized labor. They've abandoned him almost permanently.
And he takes a case which somewhat like some of the others he's taken for that matter, the McNamara brothers perhaps, which looks – pretty hopeless when he picks up in 1924 Leopold and Loeb.
Well, it looked legally hopeless, but Leopold and Loeb did look legally hopeless in the sense of were you going to be able to, you know, defend the case on the merits? And Darrow doesn't do that, as he had done in the McNamara case, and I don't want to draw any close parallel between Leopold and Loeb and the McNamara case. But in this very general sense, Darrow also pleads Nathan Leopold and Dickie Loeb guilty at the outset of the trial. And then the summer, the trial, if you will, is really a contested sentencing hearing.
And yeah, he goes on at length in the hearing about the youth of these two boys that have killed a 14-year-old.
Yep.
He seems to blame everything but the boys.
This is, again, I think at one level, it's characteristic of Darrow's own determinist view of human beings.
But these weren't poor or socially deprived individuals, were they? Actually, I think what made the case so notorious was that these two college students were so upscale in their background.
Oh, they were the sons of some of Chicago's wealthiest families. They lived on or near Prairie Avenue, which at the time was where the great wealth in Chicago maintained their homes. And, you know, this ties back to something we discussed just several minutes ago. Darrow was capable from time to time of obtaining an enormous fee, at least by the measure of his day. Now, he had come back to Chicago from Los Angeles in 1913, broke. I mean, just completely broke, destitute, and without a law practice to return to in Chicago. So after 1913, he never again really is financially secure in his life, and he's trying very hard to chase the dollar. And he's really trying very hard to not just build his law practice again, but to build his own personal, you know, bank account.
Well, and it helps to have a wealthy family involved.
What does he, in effect, promise? That's not quite the right word, but to the families who have hired him in this case, where it seemed pretty clear that Leopold and Loeb had killed Bobby Franks.
Right.
So what's in it for the families?
I think he was honest with the families and true to himself in that what he said is, I'm going to try to spare these boys from the noose. And that's all he was trying to do. Was
with the McNamaras.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, was spare them from the death penalty. Darrow had a lifelong abhorrence of the death penalty. And I'll tell you, as a criminal defense lawyer, Darrow would be worth remembering if only for this one fact. In his entire long career, which again, he embarks on criminal defense only at age 37, but he stays at it till he's 79. In his entire long career, he represented at least 100 men in murder cases. Not one of them was executed.
That's pretty amazing.
At a time when capital punishment was absolutely the rule for murder and indeed for, you know, for crimes like rape.
And so what was his approach with Leopold and Loeb?
He pled them guilty and then, as I say, had what we would call today a contested sentencing for weeks in front of Judge Caverly in Cook County Circuit Court and presented psychiatric testimony, very novel at the time.
Expert witnesses.
Mm-hmm. Expert witnesses, psychiatrists. They were called alienists at the time, but we would call it forensic psychiatry today. Presented the, you know, the best expert witnesses the wealthy parents of these two young men could afford, and also mixed in a great deal of his own really passionate views about capital punishment. His closing argument to Judge Caverly, fortunately, was transcribed verbatim and published and widely disseminated, and still one of the most stirring arguments against capital punishment you can find.
I've got an excerpt here where he's saying, "I can think and only think, Your Honor, of taking two boys, one 18 and the other 19, responsible, weak, diseased, penning them in a cell, checking off the days and the hours and the minutes until they will be taken out and hanged. Wouldn't it be a glorious day for Chicago? Wouldn't it be a glorious triumph for the state's attorney? Wouldn't it be a glorious triumph for justice in this land? Wouldn't it be a glorious illustration of Christianity and kindness and charity? I can picture them, wakened in the gray light of morning, furnished a suit of clothes by the state, led to the scaffold, their feet tied, black caps drawn over their heads, stood on a trap door, the hangman pressing a spring so that it gives way under them. I can see them fall through space and stopped by the rope around their necks." He's being rather sarcastic there about it being a glorious day for Christianity and so on, but he gives a very concrete picture of what it's going to mean for these
it's
boys.
It's very powerful stuff. You know, it's very, very powerful stuff 88 years later.
We'll look at a case where the penalty was really nominal, but the case, one of the biggest of all, the Scopes trial, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
This is Darrow, inadequately scrawled with his young old heart and his drawl and his infinite paradox and his sadness and kindness and his artist sense that drives him to shape his life to something harmonious, even against the schemes of God. That's the poem Clarence Darrow by Edgar Lee Masters from 1922. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Dean Strang, whose recent book is called Worse Than the Devil, Anarchists, Clarence Darrow, and Justice in a Time of Terror. And this hour we're talking about the well-known lawyer and civil libertarian Clarence Darrow. Darrow, I think, is most famous for his role in the Scopes trial and the colorful behavior that Darrow and his opponent, William Jennings Bryan, engaged in that Tennessee courtroom. Set the scene for us and tell us how Darrow got to Tennessee.
Well, he is probably most famed for the Scopes trial, and it's unfortunate that that's described as a trial at all in many ways. It was political theater, would be a more accurate description. It was a contrived case, really. The ACLU and others sought to challenge a Tennessee statute that barred the teaching of evolution in public school classrooms as fact. A young football coach and science teacher in Dayton, Tennessee, named John T. Scopes, agreed to be sort of the test case in the effort to overturn that law. He may or may not have read from a biology textbook to his student charges that contained a description of Darwin and evolutionary biology. In any event, he was charged by the state of Tennessee with having violated the statute. A sort of an all-star team was assembled among the prosecutors, with William Jennings Bryan invited to lead the prosecution, at least nominally. On the defense side, the ACLU, as I mentioned before, were friends of Darrow's and he of them. Both Arthur Garfield Hayes and Dudley Field Malone were to be actively involved in the defense of Scopes, and they invited Clarence Darrow to join them as their celebrity lawyer after Bryan joined the prosecution team. And the whole show opened or convened in Dayton, Tennessee, right in the middle of a very, very hot summer of 1925.
So when you have Darrow involved on the one hand, and I don't know how famous he is at this point as being, I'll just say, not a religious person, and you have Bryan involved on the other hand, who is famous for being a religious person, right away, does that just make this a symbolic trial?
There was, of course, great symbolism in that. There was a wonderful backstory that probably would have been known to many educated followers of the trial at the time, which is that Darrow and Bryan had a connection dating back at least to 1896. Bryan, of course, was a progressive Democrat, a populist hero out of Nebraska. And in 1896, he had been the Democratic candidate for president. The Democratic convention that year was in Chicago. Darrow had been in the audience to hear Bryan's most famous speech, the so-called Cross of Gold speech. And Darrow himself ran for U.S. Congress further down the ticket that same year in 1896. Bryan got crushed at the polls by William McKinley. Darrow lost only very narrowly, lost by something like 100 votes in his effort to be elected to the United States Congress. But these two men had been allies at one time, and Darrow had been fond of Bryan, although he had never liked Bryan's evangelism and sort of religious stripe. By 1924, 1925, they'd seen very little of each other. Bryan had drifted more and more toward, you know, sort of his religious interests. Darrow, of course, had become firmly entrenched as America's most famous agnostic, if not atheist, and humanist, really. Mm-hmm. And Darrow was a humanist. So, you know, these combatants were old friends, but really not current
friends. It was really a debate between two big ideas that were struggling against each other in America.
Exactly. And that was the theater of it. I mean, it was a collision of sort of, you know, science and progress in America and traditional religious beliefs met on this unlikely field in a little town in Tennessee.
And how unusual was it for Darrow to make the decision to call William Jennings Bryan to the stand and start interrogating him about his belief in the Bible? I mean, to have a defense lawyer put the prosecutor on the stand.
Well, again, if you want to sort of force the Scopes proceeding into the mold of a trial, it was, of course, ridiculous for the defense lawyer to call the lead prosecutor and cross-examine him about the Bible.
And did that testimony on the part of Bryan even enter into the decision, into the record?
No, formally, as a formal matter, the judge struck it. After
a couple of hours.
Well, after it was completed. I mean, they moved the proceedings outside onto the courthouse lawn because it was so hot and the courtroom so crowded. And so they conducted this play under the tree, you know, the elms and the sun. Today we would think of this as a long offer of proof by the defense, you know, cross-examining Bryan. The judge let it all go on and then struck it and told the jury not to consider it. But again, it's just one more reason why the Scopes proceeding doesn't fit well into the mold of a trial as we really think of it. It was theater.
Well, since we're talking about Darrow in this hour, then if you look at what he did during this Scopes trial / theater, what does it tell us about him? You know, the choices that he makes and how he presents himself.
Well, it's a rich opportunity for Darrow to be Darrow and call in all his friends from the University of Chicago. You know, he lived right near Jackson Park, just blocks from the University of Chicago campus, and he was involved in a science club and you know, various different organizations that in part were peopled by academics. So he calls in old friends and makes new ones among the scientific community, zoologists and biologists and anthropologists, and they all come down to testify as experts to strike a blow for science against, not so much against religion, but against superstition, they would have said. Judge Ralston in Ray County, Tennessee, disallows all of that, won't allow any of them formally to testify for the jury. But, you know, Darrow really got a chance to put on display his view of the world.
And somehow I assume it had to pretty much boil down into technicalities rather than big causes at the end, because the minimum fine for breaking that law was $100, and that was assessed against Scopes.
And I, for all I know, that could have been the maximum, too. I don't know. Yeah. But in fact, you're right. Scopes was found guilty in no time flat by this jury of 12 farmers from rural Tennessee. The judge imposed a $100 fine. And, you know, in terms of legal formalities, the case was over in the trial court. The Tennessee Supreme Court eventually reversed the conviction, but not on any you know, broad stroke.
Here's your $100 back.
Here's your $100 back. It reversed it on a technicality. But, of course, none of this was about the actual legal proceedings. It was about trying to sway the hearts and minds of Americans.
We just have a couple minutes left, but can you say something about Darrow as kind of a popular culture figure, whether it's the play and film Inherit the Wind or other things where Darrow becomes kind of an icon?
He does. I mean, he's had a life well beyond the grave. He died in March 1938, and books are still coming out about Clarence Darrow at the rate of one, two, or three a year in the early years of the 21st century. For whatever reason, he retains a grip on the popular imagination, and it may be that as a saint he was such a sinner, or as a sinner he was such a saint.
Are there any law schools named after him, as there probably are for William Jennings Bryan?
I know of no law school named after Clarence Seward Darrow, and we don't need another law school, but a name change would be firmly supported
What do you admire most about Darrow?
His humanism and his humanity. And I could go on for another hour about that.
Well, thank you for going on this hour with us about Clarence Darrow. Our guest has been Dean A. Strang. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air. And let's go out this time around with some music that's associated more than any other with that still controversial theme of evolution. This is the final section of Also sprach Zarathustra from the works of Richard Strauss. We'll hear it in a performance from the Chicago Symphony with Sir George Schulte conducting.